Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
We are coming upon the 12th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks that toppled New York's World Trade Center towers, damaged the Pentagon, crashed four airplanes, and killed nearly 3,000 individuals. Those events shocked the nation and the world. Not surprisingly, many people turned towards religion to deal with the horror and grief, to seek answers to a situation that seemed unimaginable. Although occurring on a Tuesday morning, 5 days prior to the typical day when most American Christians worship, churches were filled within hours following that tragic moment in our history. And while many of those who sat in the pews were speechless and looking for answers, it became incumbent upon the clergy to offer up words that would console, comfort, and perhaps even inspire those who were searching for meaning in all of this. What does a priest or pastor say at such a critical time? Are there common themes that Christian clergy fall back upon to help a nation heal and move forward? And have these themes been consistent over time, emerging during other periods of national tragedy, such as the days following the bombing of Pearl Harbor, the assassinations of President John F. Kennedy and the Reverend Martin Luther King, or the bombing of the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City? My guest today, Dr. Melissa Mathis, has been examining those very questions in a remarkably ambitious research project that involves looking at the sermons of many prominent, and some not so prominent, clergy members for over the past half century. Professor Mathis is an assistant professor of government and humanities at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy and holds a doctorate in political philosophy from the University of California, Santa Cruz, and a master's of divinity from Yale University. In addition to this project on sermons following national tragedies, Melissa has also written on topics ranging from the philosophical thought of Machiavelli to the use of religious rhetoric in campaigns. As she is a member of the faculty of the U.S. Coast Guard Academy, I have been asked to mention that any opinion expressed by Dr. Mathis is hers alone and does not reflect the policy of the U.S. Coast Guard or any other affiliated government agency. Melissa, welcome to Research on Religion.
Yes, thank you very much for inviting me.
No problem. I also have to note that though we are sponsored by Baylor University and the University of Washington, they have also disavowed all my opinions as well. I don't know if disavowing is the right word there, but they say, what are you doing, you silly person? So I should probably mention that every so often. So let's talk about these sermons after tragedies as we are coming up on the anniversary of September 11th here. That's an interesting topic, especially for a political scientist. How did you become interested in that topic?
I think like many Americans, after 9/11, I went to church. I'm Roman Catholic, and noticed that everyone was at church.
Yeah.
Every church in New Haven was full. And I started to wonder, is this always what Americans do after tragedies? And then I was interested in what the ministers were saying, in part because I wasn't happy with what the ministers were saying after 9/11. And I thought, it's just that I'm hearing this very small section of the country. And I started just looking and reading sermons across denominations and from around the country to see what ministers were saying.
Well, let me stop you a minute, though. You said you weren't happy with what ministers were saying after 9/11. Is this your particular Catholic priest in the time that you were there? I mean, did you go within 24 hours of the events, or was this your Sunday?
No, I went within 24 hours. And I also should say, as background, right, so I was living in Connecticut. My husband worked in New York. My brother-in-law worked in one of the towers. He's fine. Lots of our friends were in New York. So that day was, it's seared in my memory because all of these people that I love were in New York City, and we were trying to find them and make sure they were okay. And one of my good friends, her husband, she would say was murdered on 9/11. So because I was on the East Coast and so close to New York, I think that made it different. Even though I went to school in California, like my friends in California, the day was different for them. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, they watched it on television and were upset, but it wasn't the same as, you know, living right outside New York City.
That's interesting you mentioned that, because I was living in Washington State, as I still am right now, when 9/11 occurred. And we were just getting up at the time.
Right.
And I remember that, you know, my wife woke me up and she says, a plane hit the World Trade Center. And I thought it was a little biplane or something of that nature. And for me, it took a long time to really soak in what was happening. I actually would say even several hours. But nonetheless, it did finally catch up with it. And churches out here were filled as well. But I can imagine the impact out there on the East Coast. So you mentioned that you weren't happy with some of the things that you were hearing. And give us a little flavor of that. Was this just your priest, or was this other sermons or people coming to you and say, oh, you should have heard what my pastor said?
Right. It was that. Because I am part of the faith community and then affiliated with Yale Divinity School, started to hear, well, what were people saying? And it was real. Mostly it was about what America had lost. I think the most astonishing thing is I've read several hundred sermons now, and I'll probably read several hundred more before the book is completed on the chapter on 9/11. And I think I'm at four or five that name specific people who are killed that day. So these are sermons that are given after 9/11, primarily within 10 days to 2 weeks. And mostly what's mourned in the sermons is the loss of security, the fear that we as Americans now all feel. And this is really surprising to me as a person of faith. I thought, this is what we've lost? Like, what about mourning the people or relationships? Like, just even more typical kind of eulogies. And that's really what started the project. And I thought, okay, the last time America was attacked, let's see, Pearl Harbor, right? And you probably remember right after 9/11, many analogies were being drawn between 9/11 and Pearl Harbor, even though they are in important ways quite different. And that's where I started the project. So I went back and started reading sermons that were given after the bombings in Pearl Harbor. Again, not over the course of a year, but just over the first weeks after. And those are radically different from the 9/11 ones. They are more biblical. They are much more confident that the bombing of Pearl Harbor tells you nothing about God and everything about politics. They're convinced that God does not need the state to do anything in the ways that the 9/11 sermons think that, well, God wants the U.S. to do. And then depending on both theology and politics, the minister will recommend what he thinks God wants the government to do. In Pearl Harbor, there's none of that. There's, you know, the church writ large is completely autonomous in this and has its own authority, and God is not commenting on political life through Pearl Harbor in the way that we imagined in 2001 that God had something to say to Americans specifically through the tragedy. It's a huge difference.
You know, this difference is very interesting. I want to come back to that in a moment, but one of the things I'm interested in is, again, how you got into this project, but whether other people have ever examined this. I mean, you said you're writing a book on this. This manuscript is in the works right now. It'll be coming out soon. When you said, huh, I wonder what's going on, did you go to library shelves and say, who else has thought about this or written about this? Has there been anybody else?
So other people, other historians have written on the role of sermons as a civic education, as a way that Americans have learned about who we are, helped us construct our identities. And there's one influential book and a few others about the Puritans, right, and the sermons that were given and how the sermons were not simply or only theological tracts, but they were also narratives of citizenship. And then there's some other collections and books that were written about sermons after Lincoln's assassination and, you know, the way that the train and Americans gathered and how different parts of the country mourned Lincoln's assassination. So in that way, I'm in the tradition of recognizing that sermons are a form of civic education. And this is important to me as a political theorist because in my discipline, usually religion is just a variable, right? Like religious people vote A, B, and C, right? So in political science, we tend not to be as interested in thinking about religion as anything either as epiphenomenal, right? Meaning like, oh, it's always about something else, or simply as a variable to understand, you know, voting and elections and so forth. So this way I thought, no, I think something else is going on. You know, sermons still function in this important way in American culture, especially after tragedies. Why else would all of the churches be full? Like people who don't go to church are suddenly, you know, in church for the first time and are looking to ministers and others to help them understand and try to make sense of what's happened. So
that is an extremely important point that people went right away to churches. You know, where could you go? You could go to a library, you could go for a dinner, you know, you could go to a movie to forget about everything. But no, right. People flock to churches. And, you know, even though people say, well, you know, I'm not very religious, all of a sudden, somewhere in the background, they said, you know, this is where I help to make sense of things. And right. You really do see the central aspect of churches, even though it might not be central in their daily lives, so they don't go every Sunday, but it's something still there.
Right, and I think part of my work is because I belong to these two different disciplines, you know, the work at Divinity School, training people who are seeking ordination, and then a more traditional, you know, political scientist. I wanted these two parts of my life, too, to talk to each other, and I think that political scientists, and this is part of the narrative of American culture, like this idea of bowling alone, you know, that there's no more town hall meetings, there's no places where Americans create a collective identity, you know, we don't volunteer in the same ways as we did in the 50s and so forth. And I think it's partially true, but I think when you see, a kind of echoing what you just said, how Americans still go to church, especially when they're looking for meaning, tells you something significant about American culture, right? So yes, it may be true that we are primarily bowling alone and living in gated communities and largely isolated, but we still look to this authority to understand who we are when the way we've understood the world has been disrupted. And that's what these crises are for me. They're not really crises of the state. Like, there was no doubt that, you know, after the assassination of JFK, that the United States was going to crumble and there wouldn't be a transition to continuing a democratic government. But they were crises of meaning. Like, who are we? Well, how did this happen? You know, what kind of people are we that we assassinate our own president, one of our own? So that's what I was also interested in trying to think about.
Now, you said crises, and what you did, prompted by the events of 9/11, was to go back in time and take a look at a number of other crises. And your book is going to be bookended by Pearl Harbor, as I understand it, and then coming all the way up to September 11th, so roughly about 60 years or so. Why did you choose that time frame? Why didn't you go back any farther? And why did you choose the other events that you did to examine, sandwiched in between these two events?
So some of it is practical, right? That to try to do, you know, a 200-year period is just beyond, you know, I would be writing multi-volumes for the next, you know, two decades. So initially, the reason was because of the attacks, right? When was the last time there was a surprise attack on America? 9/11, Pearl Harbor, that felt like these, and after 9/11, we were referring back to Pearl Harbor, so that felt like a legitimate reference point. And I tried to think of broken paradigms. Like, what were the crises where Americans revisited and rethought about, like, who are we? What does it mean to be patriotic? What do we think should be the relationship between the church and the state? Those kinds of crises. So that's why I chose Pearl Harbor and JFK and Martin Luther King and the Oklahoma bombings. Again, because the Oklahoma bombings has, and then the LA race riots after the Rodney King verdict, because they are echoes of the earlier crises of both JFK, right? The Oklahoma bombing raised all these questions about, again, like an Oswald, like we did this to ourselves. Like this initially, right after the bombing, we thought, oh, it's some Islamic extremist. But pretty quickly, we knew that wasn't true. And so there was a lot of interrogation, again, about who are we? What about our culture? How did we create these kinds of citizens who then turn against us? So those were some of the reasons that I created this arc. I don't think it's a progress narrative. I think I'm trying to be careful to say these are really distinct. So many things are different, who the ministers are, how they're trained, what's going on culturally. But I also wanted to write a little bit of a big idea book. You know, I wanted to kind of think about some, you know, are there some big things that happen over the course of a 60-year period in American history?
Yeah, and it is a fascinating read. The manuscript portions that you sent to me really do highlight a lot of these facts and show how these different tragedies that you say are oftentimes echoes of one another. One of the questions, or one of the answers that you gave to my question was there's just practical purpose in terms of doing this. There's two types of books, finished and unfinished, and you always want to have the finished one, right? And so you don't want to go back too far. But that brings up other practical questions here, is that the United States is peppered with churches all over the place. Every corner of every city has a church, it seems, and there's going to be a lot of sermons given. So how did you choose to which sermons to read? I don't think you went to read every single sermon, but you certainly picked some of them. And what was the reasoning behind that? How did you choose those?
Well, so what I've tried to do is I of course have read like the quote unquote famous or prominent sermons of those periods, but I'm really more interested in what you're describing, like the church on every corner in every town. And so to try to get to that, what I did was first I have the demographic information on what percentage of Americans were Baptists in, you know, 1968, what percentage were Presbyterian. And so then I said, okay, my goal is to always read at least 100 sermons on each of the periods. Though for JFK, there are 800 sermons, believe it or not, collected at the Presidential Library.
Wow.
So that one was really easy.
They're right there in one place.
I spent the summer, and there they all were, 800 sermons that some very ambitious professor in the mid-1960s collected all these sermons from around the country. So that one was perfect, right? I had more than I could possibly use. So I've tried to, I had a research assistant. She sent 200 letters to just, we went through demographic information and literally kind of randomly picked churches in every state and different denominations to try to get to, you know, something that felt like, okay, this is proportional to what America looked like at that time, and sent them to churches and said, do you still have any sermons from whoever was minister? Sometimes we knew the name of the minister at the time. Research librarians are, I'm not a historian, and I'm in love with the research librarians. They have really helped me. I've, across the country at different archives, I've told them about the project. And then they hunt down, or they have a friend who does this work at some place, and she finds five sermons. And, you know, so it's been not systematic, but I feel like it's honest and fairly representative.
I mean, it is such a daunting task to think about this. If you think about the sermons after 9/11, you know, a lot of them have been saved on computer disks or put on the internet even. But you're going back to the 1940s, the 1960s. I mean, I can imagine that, you know, priests and pastors were just scribbling notes on a yellow pad of paper. And I, you know, do they save them or not? I mean, it's like me thinking about, did I save my lecture notes from 5 years ago? No, probably they're in a wastebasket somewhere, but somehow they get saved.
And that, I think, since this is more a qualitative study, you know, I'm trying to think about some of these more theoretical ideas. I do think you could say, I'm already reading a self-selected group. I'm reading the people who, for whatever host of reasons, their sermon was saved. Like, it's interesting at the Kennedy, often it was the minister's secretary. She's like, my minister gave this, and I'm, you know, I work at the parish, and I just wanted you to have this.
Yeah.
So it was somebody who just thought this was a great sermon. I will say that I did get two letters back from ministers who I asked about Martin Luther King, who told me that the project was completely ill-conceived, that if I had asked for sermons that were simply about God and not politics, they would have sent me things. But the fact that I am under this mistaken impression that sermons are about politics means that I am, you know, some godless heathen, which I also just thought was very interesting,
yeah,
too. They were like, you don't understand what a sermon's for. This is ridiculous. I'm not sending you anything.
No, that's true. But one would wonder if those, you said it was only two people that wrote you back with that, right?
Well, that was for the Martin Luther King.
Martin Luther King.
A particular error, too, right?
Yeah. But I'm wondering to what extent they would have had that same feeling a week or two after the event. And it had you come to them and say, listen, I'm collecting these sermons after this momentous event, and you ask them for that. Was it just an average run-of-the-mill Sunday sermon that they had? Or, I mean, I couldn't imagine that it would be.
Well, it's Palm Sunday after King is assassinated.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So that is also one of the interesting things, and ministers do talk about this, is they had to decide, am I going to give my Palm Sunday sermon, you know, that I had prepared or that, you know, is part of the liturgical calendar and I, you know, this is the one I give, or am I going to give a sermon that's about the assassination? And that is constant. Not after Pearl Harbor, they don't seem to have this same question or even allegiance to the liturgical calendar in the same way. But for JFK and Martin Luther King, often the sermons begin with this. I had to decide, and some of them will say, and I've decided not to talk about it, so here's my sermon. And they give whatever. So they kind of signal that they know it's happened, but and especially after Martin Luther King, because it is Palm Sunday, they're like, not going to talk about it, you know, may his soul rest in peace, and then they move on.
I also mentioned at the beginning of this podcast in the introduction that this is a extremely ambitious project. Reading all of these sermons, did you find it to be a daunting task? Was there moments when you were in the, maybe in the JFK library and you're on your 75th sermon, you're like, oh, I've read this one all over? Or was it always in some respect renewing at parts? You just something surprised you or jumped out at you every so often that kept you going?
There's been real pleasure in reading these. Sometimes unintentional, like some of the things are so, you know, kind of funny. It also has been in some ways like a spiritual practice, right? To be able to read all of these sermons. Sometimes they're not germane to anything I'm trying to think about, but, they say something really profound, and so that keeps me going. So I've really enjoyed it. I mean, there are some that are just terrible too, and you think to yourself, "Oh, the poor people." Awful sermon.
Well, let me ask you about that, because it's an interesting project, and you said you were motivated by the attacks of September 11th, and talking to your colleagues at Yale Divinity School, and thinking about what you saw in those days. Did you go into this project, and especially with the historical tragedies, with any specific questions in mind that you were seeking to address, or was this just, let's read these things and see what comes out and tell everybody about it?
I did have some specific questions. I was very interested in mourning, how we mourn, who we mourn for. I teach the kind of canon of political theory, so I often teach Greek tragedies, including Antigone, and which is a story in part about Antigone wants to bury her brother, but her brother has been a traitor to the polis. So I am interested in that kind of question. How does who we mourn for tell us who we are? Why does every religion have these practices of mourning? What are they intended to do for the living? I was also interested, as you would expect, just in church and state. You know, in a tragedy, right, when boundaries are being renegotiated or seem unstable, I was very interested in, is this a time when ministers start to try to renegotiate that border? And they do, right? There's many, many sermons in all of these periods that have something to say about where that line should be and why either we would have prevented this tragedy if people had taken more seriously the authority of the church, or, you know, we need to align with the state, as they say after 9/11, because this is what is required of us theologically.
Mm-hmm. You called that in the manuscript that you sent me, the theopolitical meanings of the death. That sounds like a pretty fancy political philosophy term.
I suspect that that was the prospectus was edited, because usually I think about political theology,
right,
but that probably made it sound a little more hip. Really what I'm interested in is political theology, which many people think is dead in, you know, the 2013, like we don't have it anymore. And again, that's part of my like reclamation, is that no, sermons are still a practice of political theology. So that's what I was trying to, that's another question I try to think about. And then the third is really just about patriotism. How is patriotism conceived? How do the ministers imagine the relationship between Christianity and patriotism? How can you be both? Are they separate? There are some interesting sermons after Pearl Harbor about how to celebrate Christmas after Pearl Harbor. You know, how would a Christian conduct him or herself? Can you still say Merry Christmas? Which is really surprising, because when we have that conversation, can you say Merry Christmas? It's not about whether...
Right, yeah, it's whether happy holidays or,
right,
you know,
it's more
Festivus
about the claims of secularism, yeah. But this is ministers saying, okay, what does it mean to be faithful through this holiday? And, you know...
And that must be a very difficult river to cross, I think, for a lot of pastors, because... In the wake of a lot of these tragedies, especially ones where you have an external force attacking you, like in Pearl Harbor, I mean, the gut feeling is that, whoa, you know, it's us against them now, and there's this upswelling of nativism or maybe even xenophobia in some respect. And you know, the Christian scriptures say, you know, you got to put God before all these other concerns, these more material concerns, the concern for your nation. But it's at that moment is when you're feeling my nation above all else. Yeah.
Right. It's, I think one of the things that is striking when you read the Pearl Harbor sermons is how quickly the ministers are already talking about how we're going to create peace. So there's this, yes, we know we're going to have to go to war, but we as Christians are all about the peace. So how are we going to help build the peace? What? And you're like, wow, already? You know, like not conversations about creating an enemy or it's all, they've already very quickly decided that no. And I think that's because of World War One. The ministers had felt like they had been betrayed by the U.S. government after World War One, because they really did think that they were part of building the peace. And when that disintegrated and now there was another conflict, they were like, okay, we're not playing anymore with this. We don't want to be part of the government's either imperial claims or, you know, the violence to create peace. That's not what Christians do. So very quickly they were, and talking about, like, we've already learned this lesson from World War One. We're not doing this again.
Very interesting. I want to return back to the mourning issue. So the questions you're interesting is who we mourn for, the theopolitical meanings, as you call it, or the church-state issues, and then also patriotism. You made a very interesting observation in your writings about mourning, not only how this connected back to Antigone, but you'd mentioned that Hitler had banned Antigone itself, mm-hmm. right, that actual play, but also periods of mourning. And it's mm-hmm. really interesting, and you drew my attention to this, how important the role of mourning is in a society. Talk a little bit to that.
Well, I think that what Hitler recognized, or why he said, okay, you can't, no performances of Antigone, and there is actually a French version of Antigone that was performed as part of the resistance wow. in France. So it's this idea that, you know, naming your dead, burying your dead, having this period of mourning, there's something political about that, right? And Hitler knew that, right? Which is why you have these horrific, anonymous dumping of bodies in ditches, right, to prevent anyone from mourning particular individuals. But I think also what I was interested in is, do we still mourn enough, right? Like, there's certainly been a lot of things that have been written about the kind of professionalization of funerals, and that we don't want people to get too upset. You know, you're supposed to kind of get over your grief, package it in particular ways, and sometimes we don't even call them their funerals. They're like celebrations of life, and we have all these beautiful pictures and of the person, which I think is still fine, but this idea that maybe the process of grieving really does matter to human beings, and we have to stay in that place and feel that sadness and sense of loss and tragedy instead of quickly getting over it. So I was interested in that also politically, right? I think this, that we know that the state wants us to mourn in particular ways for particular people, and to show that it can control it too. So I'm interested in that part of mourning.
Yeah, that was such a great observation, because as I was reading that, I also recalled the Arab Spring and how the Arab Spring, all these protests that have been shaking North Africa and the Middle East recently, really got started with the funeral of a street vendor in right. Tunisia. Right. And just a regular street vendor, you know, dies, his name gets in the media, but all of a sudden the mourning for him becomes a call for change in society, or a big reflection on who are we now, and is this who we really want to be? And you look back in history, a lot of political events hinge upon these not only big gatherings of people, but big gatherings in terms of mourning and self-reflection.
Right, whether it's also the mothers of the disappeared, mm-hmm. right? You know, the women in Argentina mourning the loss of their sons and using that as a political act, or even just anecdotally, how often in kind of civil strife, there's violence at a funeral to like disrupt the mourning of your enemy, right? So, you know, think of how often in the last decade you see these horrible photos of, you know, bombs going off while people are mourning their dead, right? It's very different than, say, an ancient Greek notion where you stopped fighting so that both sides could mourn their dead, and then you all agreed, like, okay, now we're going to fight again, which seems absurd to us. But, right, so important was that process of mourning and burying, or not burying for the Greeks, but memorializing your dead, that you stopped fighting to do it.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, let's go ahead and take a look at these questions, the questions of mourning, the question of church and state relations, and the question of patriotism as it pertains to these bookend tragedies from Pearl Harbor to 9/11. And we mentioned that you also look at John F. Kennedy assassination, Martin Luther King assassination. You touch upon the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City bombing, as well as the Los Angeles riots following the Rodney King verdict, and then obviously finally 9/11. Let's talk about, instead of each of these in isolation now, give us a grand sweep of what you have been finding. Have you noticed any consistent themes throughout this period? So for perhaps whenever there's a moment of tragedy, do priests and pastors, do they tend to go back to a particular book or a passage of the Bible?
I haven't found that there is a particular, no, I haven't found that there isn't a particular or even a particular set of passages. There tend to be particular passages, specific periods that they all seem to go back to, but not over the arc of this project where you'd say, oh, this passage, you know, you see it in Pearl Harbor and Martin Luther King and 9/11. I haven't seen that. Not surprisingly, what I do see is fewer and fewer references to the Bible and fewer references over the arc of the project to history. Right, so Pearl Harbor is, some of the sermons are like mini lectures. You know, they start with, you know, the Holy Roman Empire, and then they make these elaborate connections, and they tell a very long story, or some of them, you know, start with the Founding Fathers, or some of them start, with biblical narratives. By the time you get to 9/11, there are fewer citations across denominations of the Bible, and history is very short. Like, in the several hundred that I've read, like, there are no references even to Vietnam, right? So it's like history is maybe the last 10, 15 years, but none of the 9/11 sermons are telling you about the history of the Holy Roman Empire and how it brings you to 2001.
Okay, that's interesting. And you said there's fewer and fewer references to specific biblical passages. Nobody's saying, look at Job, he suffered through all this stuff too, so suck it up or something.
Right, and this is very surprising. And one of my colleagues, Nora Tisdale, when I mentioned this to her, she said, what's ironic about it is that increasingly ministers have college educations, they go to seminary. After World War II, many of them didn't go to, many of them didn't go to college, and the kind of denominational education wasn't as systematic as it is today. So you would have thought it would be reverse, where you'd say, well, you know, they didn't know the scholarship, or they hadn't been trained for 3 years to think in these terms, and they were making their sermons. But maybe it meant they had more time to read the Bible, and that was more foundational to their faith in ways that now we do more pastoral care. There are other things that ministers may be focusing on or think that their sermons need to be about. Like they may say, oh, Bible studies where I really give an exegesis of Job. But in my sermon, I'm really trying to say something about contemporary life. So
yeah,
I don't do it there.
Yeah, I could see that as you increase theological training. Many of the biblical messages tend to get more abstract. I'm wondering if you saw any consistent themes or perhaps changing themes about the theologies or the theological themes that were being emphasized. Did they talk a lot about redemption, forgiveness, sinfulness, obedience to authority? Was there anything that seems to come up consistently throughout these, or has that changed over time too?
All of those that you just named do consistently come up, but they are interpreted differently. Forgiveness is a fairly consistent theme, though in the speeches right in the sermons right after 9/11, it takes longer. So before the ministers start to talk about forgiveness, they're not talking about forgiveness at the end of September or even early October. Sinfulness is definitely there. But the difference is trying to decide, is it original sin or what is called like social sin? So are some of these things, that these tragedies, because we live in a fallen world? We are fallen. We are from the beginning depraved. And that's why these tragedies happen. Or is it social sin, that we've created these institutions and this culture that has failed, and that's why these tragedies happen? And that debate is starting from, I'd say, JFK through 9/11. That debate is really alive. And that's part of the legacy in Protestantism of Reinhold Niebuhr, right, who really wanted to try to shift, I think, toward this idea that there's original sin and Christians have to be a little more practical in their relationship with politics, that, you know, we've been too idealistic. We thought we could make everything perfect, and we can't. And it's not like if you just manage the institutions better, you could get this perfect Christian world. Whereas in Pearl Harbor, there's one great sermon where the minister says, God could beat the Nazis with his pinky finger. This is ridiculous. This is not about God, right? Like, so in the Pearl Harbor sermons, God is just so magisterial, and the state is so puny that it's just not, God's just not even interested, doesn't care. Not, you know, this whole, like, well, we should be practical, that's just not in those sermons.
Mm-hmm. Is there any blaming that goes on? I mean, one of the things that I remember after 9/11, that fingers would be pointed and saying, you are the sinner, or you, this is the problem. Sometimes it's the perpetrator, say the Islamic terrorist of 9/11, these were the sinners, or in the case of Pearl Harbor, it's the, you know, the Japanese who came. But oftentimes it's pointing at different sins in society and saying, now you're paying for this. I know there were several prominent pastors who came out and after 9/11 say, well, this is for our sins because we've become culturally depraved. Right, and so the, right, you know, pornography industry is responsible for this, and this is what we're paying for now. Do you see any of that consistently throughout this?
Oh, yes, you definitely see that. In the JFK sermons, the dominant feeling is that it's all our fault. And one of kind of my favorite sermons, the Baptist minister says, you know, one finger was on that gun, but all of us pulled the trigger. And by that, he says that the reason is not, there's some that, you know, the culture is depraved, but really the reason is that we're not being good Christians. And the Baptists particularly feel this because the assassination happens in Dallas. They're the largest denomination represented in Dallas at the time is Baptist. Their convention had been there. There's schools and seminaries or, you know, universities. And the Baptists are appalled that not one Baptist was able to prevent this from happening, which is really interesting, right? Like, no sermon, no Baptist gives a sermon like, where was the Secret Service? This is ridiculous. How come they didn't have better security? There are sermons where not one, you know, good Baptist could have met Oswald and, you know, brought him to church or helped his family or prevented this. Right there, it's really about, you have failed to be a good Christian, and that's why this happened.
Yeah, I seem to recall that sermon that all of our fingers pulled the trigger.
Right.
It seems to have been woven into our national discussion. Who said that? Do you have the name of that person?
Oh, let's see. I don't have the footnote right in front of me.
Okay. But I remember that quote, because when you said it, it says, you know, I've heard that before.
Right. And, well, what's maybe part of why you heard it, too, and I could trace it back, is the maybe more than one minister said it, and actually there are versions of that. But then it's in a Wall Street Journal editorial, and the Wall Street Journal says, this is ridiculous. We Americans did not pull the trigger. Oswald is a psychopath. He's deranged. We're not responsible for this. This is kind of what we call now like the bad apple theory. Like, this is just one rogue guy who's a wacko. It has nothing to do with American culture. So that may be part of how it became the national narrative, because the Wall Street Journal really, you know, whoever wrote the editorial content that day said, this, you know, it's ridiculous. No.
Yeah. Which I guess brings up this question, too, is there any influence that you see that prominent pastors and priests would have on others? Do you see somebody first mention a phrase, and then in the following weeks, those phrases seem to be repeated?
Right. I think you see that. And we know that this is part of how sermons circulated in the 40s, right? So there were magazines called The Pulpit, and they produced some of the what were considered the best sermons from around the country. And then ministers were expected to use those to develop their own sermons. So you do see some things that are picked up and phrases. And sometimes prominent ministers would send letters to you know, their fellow ministers in their denomination saying, this is how I think you might want to talk about this. And I have a few of those which are very interesting, like, you know, that were given. Here's ways that you might want to formulate your understanding of, you know, the U.S. is going to war and so forth.
Did you see any differences in the denominations? Was there evangelical Protestants responded differently than, say, Roman Catholics or your mainline Protestants? Or was there a sense of ecumenism that permeated all of these things that said, you know, we're all Christians and, you know, these differences really don't matter and we all see things the same way?
I think mostly it's much more ecumenical than you would anticipate, though the differences come back relatively quickly. So there's that period right around the crisis where they all do seem to be much more, we are Christians, with the exception that I just gave you about the Baptists in Dallas, particularly feeling responsible, though other denominations felt responsible as well. But then within a three-month period, there's all sorts of fighting, and it's sort of, again, interdenominational fighting, like they'll try to have some resolution, and they're back to, like, okay, we can't get along. Yes, you may have been a Christian right after the crisis, but 90 days later, you know, we're digging in around some of these differences. So initially they seem to, and they're not using those sermons to even highlight, like they don't say specific theological points that are only germane to being an Episcopalian, right? It seems much more ecumenical, I guess, or I don't know, maybe another word.
Like somehow unifying of the country,
right,
and
right.
Yeah, rallying around Christianity and the flag or something of that nature. What I want to do now is walk through some of these tragedies. And you had mentioned that there's been changes over time. And, you know, as we talk about the sermons that occurred after each of these major tragedies, perhaps you can emphasize also how things have been changing. And so let's go ahead and start back in the 1940s and look at Pearl Harbor. What happens after Pearl Harbor's attack? What is the general gist of the sermons there? And are there certain ones that stand out?
So the general gist is, first, it's not about theodicy. Right? There are no questions about why would God allow this to happen to us, or what's the nature of God because of this. There's really not the narrative of American exceptionalism then. And so in terms of, you know, kind of the political, like the things that you would expect, those aren't there. And the most of the ministers are very clear that this is a political event, and it's not a theological. It doesn't create theological, it's not a theological conundrum for them. Like, oh, how are we going to explain this? They're like, this is a political problem, and this shows you, some of them argue, why we continue to need the church, because look at what a mess politics is. You know, this is more the city of God and the city of man, and there's more, the ministers have more sense of, like, that the political realm is like a spectacle that Christians observe and see its foolishness and recognize that they have a very important role to play by not being that.
And that's absolutely fascinating to me. And you mentioned, and let me make sure that I heard you correctly, you said there were not narratives about American exceptionalism.
No.
That is fascinating.
It comes later, right?
Yeah.
At least a minute. I mean, the state is making claims about American exceptionalism,
right?
But
right.
The ministers at that point are like, no.
Yeah, and that's, I would not have expected that. I mean, did you expect that, or?
No, I didn't expect that. Right? I would have thought, oh, this is where it starts, right? But the ministers were still resisting. And I think what's also interesting, I mean, now there are so many variables, but the status that ministers had in the 40s is really different than the status ministers have in 2001.
How so?
Right? So there are these surveys that are done through the 30s, 40s, and 50s in which they ask Americans, like, which professions are do you respect the most? Who do you trust the most? And ministers consistently through those three decades are always in the top three, right? So I think that empowered ministers, too, to feel like we can criticize the state. We can say that we're better, different, autonomous in ways that by 2001, ministers, the last time I saw a survey, don't even make the top, like, 20. I don't think most people even think about it. Unless they're prompted, you know, if they're prompted, like the Pew will do these where you say, well, do you think that people who are ministers or in religious service are trustworthy? Then people may say, oh, yes. But when asked to just name, you know, which professions do you have the most respect for, ministers are not that in our culture writ large.
Yeah. Right? And you also noted, too, and this is worthy to come back to, that ministers felt, you know, betrayed or because of World War One.
Right.
Yeah. Explain that again, too, because when you mentioned that earlier in our interview, I didn't quite fully get that. And I guess that's not my reading of history. So, again, that was a big surprise when you said that.
So I think what I've been reading is that they thought that the treaties of war, right, this was the war to end all wars, and the ministers believed that there would be no more wars, that they were going to be part of building the peace, and that they wouldn't be asked again to have to support a war. And so I think also some of the chaplains from World War One, when they wrote about the slaughter and the proximity of killing other human beings, many ministers still refer to it, like how repulsive that was and how we didn't want Christians to be in that position, having to kill other human beings. And what was the expression? We call it post-traumatic stress, but what was the expression then of the equivalent of having post-traumatic stress after World War One?
Shell shock or something.
Yeah, shell shock.
Yeah.
So, and this is when we begin to try in that interwar period, ministers create the conscientious objector, right? They want there to be this status for conscientious objectors so that, you know, you can say, because of my religious commitments, I don't want to fight in another war. So I think that's what makes many Protestants suspicious, right? And most Protestants were against going to war. And, you know, Roosevelt was annoyed with, you know, how many Protestants were resisting his kind of attempts to court them and to say that the war is, that, you know, America's response would be Christian. In fact, he sends right away after the bombing of Pearl Harbor and the declaration of war, a note saying, this will be a Christian war. It will not violate Christian principles. Don't worry. So I know I'm not giving you probably enough details now, but there's all of these different elements that make the Protestant ministers suspicious that they're being led down some rosy path and it's just being used as recruiting their congregants to some political war that they don't really need to be a part of.
There's going to be more details in your book, and obviously when it comes out, we'll point people in that direction. But it is, now that I think about the history back at that time, America had entered an isolationist period again after right. World War One, and so many people were, I guess, hunkered down in their churches and say, hey, you know, Europe's a mess again. We don't want any of this. And I guess that would come through in all parts of our culture, including our religious culture. Let's fast forward 22 years now to the John F. Kennedy assassination. And, you know, here we've gone through several decades of, you know, we defeated the Germans, we defeated the Japanese, we emerged victorious from war, we emerged as the world superpower. We have a spectacular period of economic growth, automobiles, and all that kind of stuff is coming forward. And it looks like happy days are here again. And then JFK is assassinated. And One thing that you mentioned, too, in the prospectus that you sent me for this book is that it happened on an unseasonably warm and sunny day in Texas in November. And just like in Pearl Harbor, you know, it's going to be very nice in Hawaii at that time. But it's, you know, this beauty, the beauty of America that had become is shattered by this incident. Is, oh, my, the president has been assassinated? How did the clergy react to this? And was there any differences with what happened two decades ago in how they responded to Pearl Harbor?
So, obviously, part of the difference, first, one of the similarities is that even though we think about JFK as being the first kind of televised tragedy, right, where Americans were riveted to what one commentator calls the altar of their televisions for, you know, 4 days. Most Americans still found out from a neighbor or a person either coming, you know, calling them or running over, or, you know, they were in the grocery store and somebody told them, which is how most Americans found out about Pearl Harbor. With the later tragedies, most of us find out kind of from more anonymous sources, like, you know, television, the radio, or...
And almost instantaneously.
Right, and right, almost instantaneously. So the ministers, they're aware that this... What's interesting, I think, is all those things you just said, like everything is fantastic, we're, you know, this world power, and the ministers are embarrassed. Also, they're like, oh, people are going to think that America really isn't that great. So we're not as, like, secure yet in our status. There's a kind of shame, too, of, oh, this is so embarrassing for our standing, for our status as a world power that, you know, we've assassinated our own president. But they really canonize Kennedy, and you probably know this, right? Like, so Kennedy's not that popular with the American citizens before he's assassinated. He's not particularly beloved by civil rights movement. Not, you know, he's not, ministers certainly aren't courting him, but one of the most common biblical references is how he dies like Jesus, like he's a martyr, and there's all of these analogies to Kennedy as Christ, and it's astonishing, and it is, some of it is quite hyperbolic, but he really is immediately reread as having died for what he believed in. He was on a campaign tour. He wasn't campaigning for civil rights or any specific position. He was doing the tour to, you know, for his campaign, but the way the ministers and also the media is that, you know, he dies for civil rights. He's a martyr for these ideas. That's why he's killed, you know, and he's of the people. And you know, and what makes him so amazing is, you know, he's this really wealthy man, but we could all identify with him. And the family, the Kennedy family, Jacqueline Kennedy and the children become the Holy Family. There's these analogies, and you're like, oh, my God.
Yeah,
no. That ministers are really using these kinds of metaphors to describe the assassinated president.
Yeah, so, that's very interesting that the iconography of, right, of JFK was definitely built after the assassination and not beforehand. Yeah.
Right, and there are all these condolence letters, which I read many of, and this is when you could see me, like, weeping in the presidential library. So Jackie Kennedy saved all of them and then had a staff of, I don't know, 20 who returned cards thanking people for sending their condolence letters. And so many of the condolence letters were about how the assassination of Kennedy was like when their father died or their husband died, and how they can't sleep and how personal the death was for them. And this is, I think, noteworthy and then disturbing because we have some of the condolence letters that was sent to Coretta Scott King after Martin Luther King is assassinated, and they're completely different, right? So the white people who sent her condolence letters say, what a loss this is to your community or to your people, right? They don't feel like that they have lost anyone or even that America has lost anyone. It's like, this is terrible for you. And maybe even more surprising is the majority of condolence letters sent from black folks say, we knew he was going to die. Now this is what you should do. And they give her recommendations for what she should be doing now to continue the movement. So it's like, this is terrible. We knew he was going to be killed, and now we really, the Abernathy should be head. Or here's the things you should focus on, or you should make a tour and go to this state or that. And you're like, this is a condolence letter?
Yeah. It becomes much more politicized, I think,
yes.
and less emotional. But so that, I guess, that takes us then to how those are condolence letters. That takes us now to how the clergy responded. Did they reflect that in their sermons, or did we see the same kind of sermons that we saw for Kennedy occurring with the assassination of Martin Luther King?
No, I think that my reading now, and the first thing is it's very, very difficult to find sermons given after MLK was assassinated, which is surprising because there are all of the King centers and archives, and several of the research librarians in Atlanta and Stanford have tried to help me, and they are surprised that no one thought to save these. So that's the first, and I write about this a little in the book, like how the fact that it wasn't saved is itself important. But the ones that I have, they're the saddest sermons, I think, in the whole collection, because the ministers, I think, really feel defeated, like it's over. The Prince of Peace has been killed. That's what they call Martin Luther King. And so, you can read the sermons as really wondering, like, is the Christian ethos ever going to work? Like, if Martin Luther King can't do it, you know, this man who embodied so many of these Christian principles of nonviolence and reconciliation, and he can't survive, then maybe Reinhold Niebuhr's right. Like, we got to just give up, you know? We got to be more like the state, or we need the state to fix this because we can't seem to do it. And so they're really very sad. And Martin Luther King is not analogized to Christ. He is analogized to a disciple, and the fulfillment of his life is his death. It's like he served Jesus, and now he's dead, and that's it, right? There's not a lot of, like, keep the dream alive, we have to continue. You know, the sermons are not like that. The condolence letters from, black folks across the country are, more political, but the ministers seem to really just feel defeated. Like,
yeah.
Okay, that's it.
And it is a period of our time that's extremely turbulent, and one could imagine that it's reflecting that. I mean, Robert Kennedy is going to be assassinated shortly thereafter.
2 months later. So
yeah.
You have Kennedy, Martin Luther King,
you have riots in the street and Watts and all that.
Right,
yeah.
And you have the rioting, and that's also, I think, interesting, again, around the mourning, is how do you mourn? What's appropriate mourning? And in this way, the black ministers defend the riots as a form of mourning. And the white ministers are like, this is disrespectful to Martin Luther King. And the more of the African-American ministers see that, like, no, this is what grief looks like when you feel completely disenfranchised and full of despair. This is legitimate grief. And the white ministers, and also obviously how it is narrated politically, is that, like, Martin Luther King wouldn't want people, destroying property and, turning over cars. Like, he's about nonviolence. You have to mourn him in the way he lived. And Coretta decides to try to mourn Martin Luther King in some ways like Jackie Kennedy did, including like how she dresses. She had the hat made, if you've seen some of the pictures, that is very much reminiscent of the one that Jackie Kennedy wore. But she decided to have the casket open and was very intentional because she wanted America, she says, to see yet another dead black man. Like that, she wanted America to see, like, this is what you do to black men. So she was aware that there was a contest about how what is appropriate to mourn. And, you know, some people thought, no, you shouldn't have had his body. You know, like, it should have been covered with the American flag and, you know, much more discreet. And she was like, no, I want people to see what has happened.
So you definitely can see the tenor of sermons changing, and you can start to see some differences here, too. Let's finish up with the time that we have and fast forward to September 11th, as we are just now a few days away from that. What happens between MLK and September 11th, 2001? Again, about another two decades, a little bit more. Is there a change? What kind of changes do you see, and what are we seeing in these sermons?
I mean, there's so, right there, there are very many things that change, and I hope to try to be, you know, very robust in detailing those changes. That said, one of them is, I think that that feeling of defeat that you read in the through the 60s means that many ministers decide to line up with the state, decide that the government is going to be able or better able to fulfill Christian principles than the church itself can. And, you know, we know this, say, as factual in terms of the alliances that evangelicals begin to make in the 70s, right? Like, initially a kind of refusal, like, we're evangelicals, we don't run for election, to this is the best way to fulfill our mission is to be in politics. And they're not the only denomination that does that. There's just even a kind of theology that develops that right, God is on her side, sort of meaning that God kind of needs the state to fulfill his ambitions, you know, or his purposes, as opposed to what the Pearl Harbor ministers are saying, which is God could defeat the Nazis with his finger. He doesn't need America or any of it. You know, it's irrelevant. Now you begin to really see, and that's, I think, a very important change. I think there's also the second is kind of what I was alluding to earlier. There, when you read the 9/11 sermons, they're not really that mournful, right? They're not in that, like, you don't cry when you read many of the 9/11 sermons because they're already trying to fix it and move on and explain it, right? So they're not stories of families torn apart or, you know, the potential that's lost on that day of these human beings and their relationships. They very quickly want to go to, okay, what is God trying to tell us? How are we going to fix it? It doesn't. Most of the ministers don't think that God is reprimanding America. Some of them do, right? Some of them are like, this is your chastisement. But most of them think that this is God's intervention to say, America is great. I'm going to help you. I'm going to be here for you to recover yourself. This is your, like, chance for redemption. And they're not really about mourning, right? They're not. And I think that actually is how we responded in some ways to 9/11. We've pretty quickly moved on to, okay, like, what's going to be done? How are we going to fix this?
Yeah, and that's interesting how at the beginning of our interview you had mentioned that that message really didn't resonate with you as somebody who knew people who were there and who were probably for 24, 48 hours just immensely concerned about what was going on. Your grief, your mourning was very, very personal, whereas the rest of the nation wasn't just quite making that making that connect.
Right, and there have been other books written now about, you know, the psychology of mourning, what's lost when people, you know, individually don't mourn, and what might be lost social, you know, in a societal level when an entire society doesn't mourn. And what mourning requires you to pause and to, you know, reflect. And I think that partially because by 2001 we were convinced of our own righteousness, convinced that God was on our side, that we are an exception, that, and there was also that, you probably remember too, that sense of like, how dare you? Like, how dare you do this to us? And initially, right, you remember, you know, how the whole world felt so much sympathy for America, in part because they were like, oh, you know, America has suffered, like we, whatever the people from around the world, like we have suffered. And our response was primarily not like, we identify with your suffering, as much as it was, how dare you do this to us? Like, nobody makes us cry. Like, we will not tolerate that. So I think that's, and the ministers are part of that, which is really surprising. Not all of them, but, you know, in the, I guess now close to 300 that I've read, it's still really the majority sensibility is, you know, we are not going to be afraid, you know, we're still going to be secure. And you're like, really? This is what you want to say, like 3 days after 9/11?
Yeah, no, quite interesting. We're coming up at the end of our time here, and you're still in the process of writing this book, and we look forward to it. And once it is published, we'll make sure that all of our listeners are pointed in its direction. But in the process of doing this study, and you've been really thinking about it, you know, for a dozen years now, what have you really learned from this? Are there any big takeaways that you say, oh, okay, I've really change my mind on a lot of things and how I view the role of the pastorate or the role of religion in U.S. society?
I think for me it has recast my sense about the relationship between church and state authority. And I, even though what I just said about 9/11 is, you know, kind of discouraging, I still feel optimistic about the power that the church can wield in political life. And that, I guess, part of what I've learned, and also maybe part of what I want to say to ministers, is don't give up, right? Like, continue to remember that the pulpit has this enormous power to shape how Americans as citizens, not just as Christians, think about their political life. That's definitely one of the things that I feel encouraged about from the book, is the kind of reminder that especially when there's instability, the church is still largely influential in how Americans think about their world.
Well, I think it certainly will be. It does certainly remind us of the relevance, and also provides a bright light that our religious life does still impact us in many ways. So in terms of that, we've been talking today with Melissa Mathis. Melissa, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.